happiness, in my opinion, happiness is usually the best feeling that you need to go after. But when you think about it, it takes a bit of effort because people keep wanting to be more happier and they don't know when to stop trying. And then, but you've also spoken about peace. And so I think being at peace is great, but it takes years to practice. Think about the first time anyone ever meditated and whatnot, right? There's always a lot going on, even when there isn't. So I actually think, and I want to get your opinion on it, I think contentment is a goal. Realizing nothing is missing from your life, right? A new car would be good, but you don't need it. A promotion would be nice, but you're not sad without it. It just lets you be in the flow state, that things are coming and going, and you're fine either way. How do you think about that? Contentment as opposed to happiness and peace being the goal.
I think it's really hard to discuss these topics because there's no direct path to them. And we all have different visions of what they mean in our heads. And most of the problem, most of the time, is not a path to get there or that we aren't there. It's just that our mind is always in the way. So any technique that you and I were to devise to become happy, our mind would become preoccupied with that technique and it would keep us from being happy. In fact, the pursuit of happiness itself, the direct pursuit of happiness is kind of the surest path to unhappiness. For example, one popular path to happiness is taking recreational drugs. And so then you end up spending all the time that you're not on the recreational drug, craving the recreational drug. So for every moment happy, you spend many more moments unhappy and craving that happy state. So just even chasing happiness can't be done directly. It's a failure. It's a direct failure. So when I talk about happiness and peace and contentment, these are not techniques. These are not systems to get you there. These aren't even systems to get me there. These are just a large collection of personal realizations that I have, which is part of my longing for a peaceful existence. And, you know, and it all kind of seeps into the character of my being and it helps change my day-to-day experience. But this is not math. This is not science. This is not even knowledge. It's not even transmissible. The only thing that someone can transmit to you in this context is a longing for you to find it yourself. And that longing will perhaps create some kind of a path for you that is unique to you. But if you were to take all my comments on all of these non-material topics, they'd probably sum to zero, just like all wisdom does. It's just not transmissible. So trying to parse another person's wisdom is a fool's errand. If it reminds you of something, if it you know, creates a feeling inside of you that was already there, if it helps have a pointer for you when you're in a you know, difficult period in your life, all of that is helpful. But you can't take this as a to-do list. That is the surest path to failure. Look, if you really wanted to be peaceful and content and happy, however you define it, whether it's equanimity or whether it's joy, whether it's bliss, if that was your number one overwhelming desire in your life, you would figure it out. And only you can figure it out because it's just a game going on in your head. It's just a series of chemical reactions happening in your head. You know, there's like 15 Navals in this room right now, right? And every single one of them is having a completely different internal experience, even though most of us are having sort of the same external experience of sitting in this room and talking to each other. So there's not much I can say on the topic that makes any sense. There's no to-do list that I can give you. And I know that's unsatisfying, but you know, that's why there's no shortcuts. Look, your own mind is your own filter into reality. So how you have to adjust your filter, and only you know how your filter is set up, and only you can examine why it's set up that way, and only you can evaluate what parts of it that you like and don't like. Nobody else can do that for you.
And that changes over time too. So even for you, for the one Naval, or for me, for Sumeya, I think that definition or that feeling, the time component of it becomes really important. Saba and I think we had the same question around this, so this was helpful. Other people in the room, we discussed, we all wanted to ask questions. So anyone else, Chris, would you like to ask yours?
Sure. So Naval, thanks for joining. This has been sort of a fun, we were discussing before, it's actually less about getting you in the room and the enjoyment that we're having of trying to figure out how to do it. So the fact that you're here is sort of the next step in that enjoyment. So thank you for joining us. So this is a sort of silly question, but I'm curious, do you think we're living in a simulation? And if so, does that even matter?
Yeah, I think it's a meaningless question. All simulation theory does is it gives you a probabilistic explanation for why this might not be real, that this might be a dream. But beyond that, it doesn't actually do anything. It gives you a plausible mechanism and a probability that it's likely to have happened. That's the claim of simulation theory. But then in every other respect, it's indistinguishable from God, right? From any God theory, because you just replace God with a great programmer. You've replaced kind of the Maya illusion slash dream with the simulation, and it's not falsifiable, and it doesn't make any interesting predictions about the world that can be tested, and the basic story is so easy to vary by changing who the programmer is and what the programmer wants and all that stuff that it's not a tight explanation or scientific theory in any sense of the word. So it wouldn't pass any of the Karl Popper tests. So it's kind of a meaningless discussion, and I think it's just religion for nerds.
I love that. Thank you.
Hey, Naval. I just had a question. I had mentioned, probably said earlier before you got in here. I was curious as to a lot of the talk around happiness and inner peace. What is it that drives you on an everyday basis that allows you to stay honed in on those core, internal principles?
I would say that we all have multiple drivers in our life. And there was a time in my life when I was driven mostly by the desire to make money. I didn't want to be poor. And there was a time in my life when I was driven by a desire to be healthier. There was a period where I was kind of unhealthy. And so, we go through different desires, but I would say the overwhelming underlying latent desire that I've always had since I was small and kind of resurges when all the other desires are put to rest is just a natural curiosity about the world and why it works and how it works and what exactly is going on here. And as I get older, I can attach fancy words to that. Like I can say, I'm looking for truth, right? Because what I end up reading mostly is science and philosophy, because those are both truth seeking. And I end up gravitating from fiction to nonfiction because, fiction is by definition not true, although it may be trying to express things that are true. So I would say it's mostly a curiosity and a desire to understand. But of course, that core desire does get muddled by many, many other things. So I would say curiosity is kind of my core drive in it, if I have everything else that I want. Now, of course, like other people, I don't always have everything else that I want. So I go and get those other things first. But if I have everything else that I want, then I'm left with curiosity for the truth.
I have a question about that. So children exhibit that a lot more than many of us adults do. In your own kids, how have you been nurturing and allowing them to keep that?
Yeah, that's a very astute observation. So I only realized this was true about me from watching my own kids. And I think kids naturally are very, very curious. It's beaten out of them. If you think about what school does, one of the reasons why I kind of harsh on the industrial education system a lot is because it basically replaces curiosity with compliance. The industrial education system is there to train factory workers. It's not there to train independent thinkers or curious kids. And the moment someone tells you what the right way and the wrong way to think is, then they're kind of taking you out of the truth. So I believe that actually it's a combination of well-meaning adults plus society plus the education system as it's currently built that destroys your natural curiosity. Look, if you remember school, right, there were kind of the kids who didn't do that well. Then there were the kids who did really well, like the straight A 4.0 students. Those were rarely the most successful people in life later. The ones who did the best later in life were actually kind of the system hackers, the ones who did the bare minimum to get the good grades or get good enough grades, or they dropped out of the school game altogether. But then later in life is where they sort of triumphed. And this could range from, Revenge of the Nerds to Revenge of the Misfits, Revenge of the Iconoclasts. And so it's really the kids who were able to resist what school was trying to do to them, which is make them conform, who did the best later in life. And I'm not faulting the school system. Like the school system is a needed combination between daycare plus education plus socialization. And so it does absolutely serve a purpose. You don't want, child being completely illiterate or what have you. But that said, it does, because of its nature, it's a scale industry. Right? It has to be one teacher plus per 50 students or whatever that ratio is. And so by the nature of making something scalable, you stop making it individual. And so you take away the humanity. You know, if you have to raise your hand to go to the bathroom, if you have to raise your hand to go get a bite to eat, if you, you know, crave going into nature, but you're forced into this small, sterile environment all the time, if you're forced into playing social games when you don't want to play social games, or getting into status hierarchies and so on, or when you're just forced to live an artificial life, knowing that it doesn't reflect the life outside the window or outside the door, then you're naturally going to be forced to conform, and it's going to take some of the curiosity out of you, or you're going to be a rebel and you're going to be getting in trouble. So I do believe that it is the industrial education system that takes curiosity out of kids' lives. And so I do think the homeschooling movement is very important. And I also think that it's really important, like if you have young kids, to always answer all their questions. Never, ever, you know, tell a child like, you know, that you don't have time to answer their questions. Or the one thing that I try not to do is I try not to talk down to my kids, and I don't give them false answers. I would rather give them the real answer and have them not understand it and then stumble over trying to explain it in a way that perhaps they will understand it. But I never want to leave that why question unsatisfied.
Naval, this is Rahul. Actually, a quick question for you, actually. Picking back of what you just said, what inspired to get where you are to today, and like, and also what inspired you to start AngelList? And just really, I'm really inspired by your work, and I've been following your work for a while. So just wanted to know, like, what, how did you start from the ground and up? And just want to get some advice on that. Yeah, thank you. And like, on how to become a better entrepreneur. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's easy to stitch together narratives of why we do what we do after the fact. But the reality is that life is just very path dependent. You're in a certain situation and you're faced with a bunch of choices. And sometimes you can also blow up out of those choices, but you just take whatever path is in front of you. And so I just followed the path that was in front of me. It's if you had dropped me into 1,000 different universes, I wouldn't have started AngelList 1,000 times. I probably wouldn't even be an entrepreneur 1,000 times. But there were certain things that I was just drawn to. I was drawn to science because it's the study of truth, and I just really respected and admired the scientists growing up, the great scientists. And I also wanted to make money, and the intersection of science and money is technology. So that sort of led me to technology. And then the center of technology was the tech industry in the San Francisco Bay Area. So that kind of pulled me towards Silicon Valley in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I had to go there. And then when I got there, I realized I'm not actually the hardest working person. You know, it's, I don't like working hard. I'm kind of a lazy person, to be honest. I do end up working hard, but I don't like to do classic work. Like, you could not get me to do a 9-to-5 job and show up on time and sit at a desk and answer questions, you know, from my bosses. And I never liked bosses. I never liked straitjackets. I was fired from my first internship. Reality and suffering hits us when we can no longer deny what reality is telling us. So like, your girlfriend breaks up with you, you don't want to acknowledge the relationship was bad, but the moment she leaves you, that's the moment you suffer. You're crying. You're forced to face the reality, and all the expectations you had of where this thing was going to head, you know, come rushing back out of you and have to crash to the floor because you'd been denying reality all along. So these moments of trauma and suffering are what actually bring us back to reality. They force us to reconcile with ourselves. They force us to improve and change, and they actually build a closer relationship for us with reality and with ourselves. So I would say that the most important turning points in your life are actually the ones where you had the most trauma. Because if I were to take those away, I would take away the story of your life, and what would remain would be pretty boring.
Hey, Naval, a quick question about that tweet about the internet and the three stages of the internet and these epochs of evolution. How would you compare, projecting the blockchain out into the future, how do you look at that and compare it against the mobile and web, you know, parts of this journey? And what's different about it? And maybe what's the same, so we might be able to see patterns, but also differences.
Yeah, I put up a tweet recently for the references. I said that the three most important epochs of the internet were first the web, second mobile, and third blockchains. And obviously, this is going to be controversial. Lots of people jumped in my comments to tell me how I was wrong. But look, to say anything interesting, you know, you kind of say something that's half true or at least partially true. Nobody knows the exact future. Nobody knows exactly how the internet is playing out. And obviously, there will be other acts like VR, AR will probably be quite interesting when it arrives. And AI, which I think is a little overhyped, you know, if it materializes, would be a total game changer, especially AGI. But I think the thing that's most interesting that's going on right now in technology is blockchains. And by blockchains, I mean these decentralized consensus mechanisms that enable us to form everything from corporations to networks to protocols to products that are operated by the community of users underneath or interested users underneath, as opposed to being owned by centralized entities. And so the first wave of the internet, we saw the creation of classic web companies. And the second wave of the internet, we saw Apple and Google basically take over by the App Store and the Play Store, and also a few other behemoths like Amazon and Netflix and, you know, and so on, rise up, and Facebook. But now I think the most interesting action is going in blockchains. And Bitcoin is the obvious one, which is we're literally redefining what money is and moving it onto the internet, as opposed to having it be in the possession of any single government or small group of people. And I think there will be hugely beneficial repercussions to society for doing that. But then with Ethereum, we're building an entire decentralized stack of Wall Street on top. All the things that Wall Street does, or London or Shanghai or Hong Kong or New York, you know, do with all their financial institutions is being done better and easier and smoother on this decentralized finance stack. And it doesn't quite work yet. It's a Rube Goldberg machine, but it's getting better and better. One analogy I made was, I think that DeFi, decentralized finance, and smart contracts are like building castles made out of math, you know, that are floating in the sky and freely trading with each other. This is like this old city-state model of free trade and impregnable protection of property and privacy, which is kind of a fantasy. But that's really, if you go back in human history and you look at when humans have made great leaps forward, it's been in city-state models, whether it was Greece with Athens and Sparta, or whether it was Renaissance Italy with Florence and so on. But I think we're building the virtual equivalent of that using blockchains. And I think we will also see huge advancements in decentralized mechanisms for building decentralized social networks, for building decentralized, you know, they call it non-fungible tokens, or decentralized registries of items and assets, both digital and pointing to in the real world. And we will see decentralized game worlds. And eventually, to my mind, a blockchain is actually a precursor for a metaverse. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Like when VR, AR really, really takes off, it's going to have to be global, just like the internet was. It's going to have to be permissionless, just like the original internet was. It's going to have to be censorship free for people to dream and to create and to imagine, as opposed to trying to fit into, you know, whatever the local boss thinks that you should and shouldn't do. It's not going to be owned by Mark Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg and his crew are not going to create the next internet, because we just won't have it, nor by Jack Dorsey, nor by Jeff Bezos, nor by any of them, nor by Tim Cook, benevolent dictator. So they might control the hardware that lets us in, but hopefully there will be competing hardware standards, and they will let us into one large decentralized open space. And that decentralized open space is going to need to know how to allocate resources, how to pay for things, how to protect users' data and privacy, how to interlink with each other. And these are the kinds of distributed consensus and payments problems that blockchains are extremely good at solving. So I'm pretty confident that not only are blockchains the most important thing going on right now, but they're also the fundamental layer for whatever comes next. Now, due to their design, they're basically venture capital done in public, right? The way these companies work is they create a protocol, then they IPO, and then they raise money. Like literally their first act is an IPO, and then after that the investors start coming in. Whereas the classic tech model, which is closed to the average investor by regulations, basically makes people like me wealthier and keeps you from doing venture capital investing until it's really late in the game, and then the company IPOs and most of the appreciation is gone. And I might have made 100x or 1000x, and you get to fight for 20% a year. So with blockchains, because the currencies built on them are permissionless, they IPO on day one. So what you're seeing is venture capital in action, unregulated, with lots of scams and pumps and dumps and lots of clones and forks and really bad actors. And 99% of it is junk, as opposed to normal startups where 90% of it is junk. So it's even worse than the normal setup. So to people, it looks really scammy and looks really worthless, but this is kind of an IQ test. It's really going to differentiate the capable people from the incapable people. So, you know, the vast majority of what happens in blockchain land is going to be terrible, but I believe that there will be a piece emerging out of that. And I think we've already had a few huge bits around Bitcoin, Ethereum, DeFi, and so on. And now we're seeing with NFTs, and soon I think we'll see with social protocols and with gaming protocols, we're going to see massive revolutionary shifts. And it's a nature of technology that by the time the shift materializes, it's too late for the incumbents. When the iPhone showed up to Nokia and Erikson, it must have looked like Martians had just landed, you know, from space with battleships, and there was just nothing they could do. If you're sitting at Nokia and you were told, hey, let's go make a Nokia phone to compete with Apple, you would just weep, because there's nothing you could literally do. You'd have to write this massive software stack and build a touchscreen phone, and you know, it was just impossible. It was a computer, which was just a whole different thing. So I think the same way that when blockchain-based technologies really become frictionless and well-implemented and seamless, that they're just going to overwhelm the current technologies that they're facing. They'll just be so much more capable, unimaginably powerful compared to what we have out there in the centralized models.
So is that moment when it, you know, gets over the chasm and gets over to regular people using it, web and mobile? I remember those moments. I tried to, you know, enter this new world, and it was very challenging. You got to get your MetaMask, you got to figure out all this stuff, and it's quite confusing. And I mean, it could be me, obviously, it could be user error, but there, you know, my experience was very difficult. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how that's going to happen.
Yeah. The early versions aren't designed for the average user. And people who say, I'm looking for an app, give me an app that an average user uses every day, are missing the point entirely. The average user every day is not involved in stashing gold bricks in their house, right? So it doesn't really replace. So Bitcoin competes with that. It's a store of value. The average person is not busy trading exotic derivatives on Wall Street. Right. So the early versions of this stuff, yeah, MetaMask looks weird to you, but hey, MetaMask is letting you be your own bank. It's letting you basically do your own high frequency trading, or it's letting you do your own lending and borrowing, or your own staking, or your own, you know, yield optimization. It's letting you do things that you just could not do otherwise, like literally would be physically and virtually impossible in any other model. So it's not like you're getting a shitty version of the Model T where, you know, yeah, okay, you know, people are driving a car and now I have a shittier car. No, what you're able to do with MetaMask is literally everybody else is driving their nice car and you've got the world's first airplane. It can barely get off the ground. You're wondering why. It's such a Rube Goldberg machine, but what you're dealing with is a completely different beast. So yeah, it's not ready for prime time. By the time it is ready for prime time, these blockchains will be worth many, many trillions of dollars, and they will be just a short step away, I believe, from dominating our financial system.
It's hard to see when that happens in the future, because it's so decentralized that it's the speed of the system itself is really hard to wrap your head around. That's
Every new technological revolution does not even vaguely resemble the one that came before it. They're not predictable by definition. If they were predictable, we wouldn't need the technological revolution. We could just cut to the chase.
Yeah, but clearly you saw something in the future that you made a right. You made AngelList, so you obviously saw some opportunity, which was something in the future. And so I think it's a process we go through.
Yes. Yes, individuals place bets. We place bets. So what I'm doing is I'm placing my bets. Does not mean I know what's going to happen. Doesn't mean I'm always right. What I like to do is I like to place asymmetric bets, where if I am right, I will be paid extremely well. And if I am wrong, I just lose my little entry fee. So they have lottery ticket-like characteristics, except that they're more likely, the expected value is positive, unlike the lottery where it's negative. So I'm placing my bets. And I'm not afraid to place my bets in public. I might be wrong. And that's fine. I don't mind the public humiliation. That's meaningless. Money, on the other hand, is real, that I can spend it. So I'm happy to place that bet and make my bets, and you can do whatever you would like. In fact, the less people who get it from the traditional investing background, the better it is for people like me.
I want to totally change gears and speak about something else, if we may. You said something about don't build castles on other people's beaches. You know, Twitter's a beach, Clubhouse is a beach, implying that we should own the relationship ourselves. Is text messaging our own beach? Is WhatsApp group a version of that or not?
Yeah, that's your own beach because you can switch it, because the contact list is inside your phone. So if WhatsApp deplatforms you, you can switch to Signal. And if Signal removes you, you can go to WeChat. WeChat removes you, you can go to Telegram. You have lots of options. It's these giant coordinated consensus systems where we're all put together in one place and there's kind of one overlord who's deciding who gets to talk and who doesn't that I don't love. So I think once Twitter started censoring people, its days were numbered. That's the point at which everybody knows that it's not permanent, right? Having Twitter followers is not a permanent thing because Twitter could kick you out. That's the obvious thing, but they could change their algorithm. They could literally just change their algorithm and then kick you, and then you would basically lose followers. Or Twitter could just go out of business, you know, 20 years from now. Or they could just roll out a whole bunch of boneheaded features, and those features could just basically rob the platform of all vitality. I actually think Twitter has now become an incredibly unpleasant place to be. Just maybe it's just me because I have a lot of followers, but I also think that there was something happened in 2020 that broke most people's online brains. And a lot of the crazies just came out of the woodwork. And they were always there on Twitter, but they just went even crazier. So I just find the quality of the discourse on Twitter has completely collapsed. So those are not your followers, right? That's a temporary thing. It's a castle built on sand. Now, is there an alternative? No. The blockchains are not quite yet ready for prime time. Blockchain social networks are not here yet. And so it's very difficult. That said, people are getting smarter and smarter about knowing where to find others. You can collect people on an email list. It's not quite the same thing. And you know, if I really wanted to build a media following, then I would focus on the free and open internet, which means my blog, my podcast, and my email list, all of which are kind of interesting. But the reality is I don't really care that much. I don't get that much out of having an audience. You know, some days it's just like, what is it? This is Saturday night and here I am because I got summoned to this room, right? So is this a net positive for me? How is this improving my life, right? So I'm very practical that way. And I don't think fame gives you all that much in modern society. It's much more of a trap in many ways than it is, you know, than it has benefit. Now, obviously I enjoy it at some level or I wouldn't even be here. So yeah. I'm contradicting myself by the act of being here. But that said, I you know, if I were trying to build something solid, then I would count on my podcast, I would count on my blog, and I would count on email subscribers and a newsletter. Notice how Substack has a much nicer censorship policy than, for example, a Clubhouse or a Twitter does, because Substack knows they don't have a network effect. They know that you're free because you have all your subscribers' emails. So you can pack up and leave at any time. Like this new Twitter super follow thing, you know? Looks interesting, but I wouldn't use it because I don't want to invest more into the Twitter platform. I just think that's you're just building more elaborate ramparts in your castles on sand. And the same way, like, yes, I'm an investor in Clubhouse, but I was a seed investor in Twitter also. And so if Twitter launches Spaces and Clubhouse exists, I'm still going to use Clubhouse. Why? Just because of redundancy. I want to be on two different platforms. I want to have followers in two different places. Because then if one of them cuts me off, I've still got my followers in the other place. So just from a pure redundancy perspective, it's better to use multiple platforms. But these are all just short-term defensive measures until I hope sometime within the next decade we can get back to decentralizing these things so that our kids aren't basically just serfs on somebody else's farm.
You might have found it unpleasant, but we found it pleasant because that's how we got your attention on Twitter. So shout out to that. You brought up something really interesting, I think, which is a good segue for Clubhouse. Can you talk about when you became an investor in Clubhouse? Because that Periscope I listened to today that inspired me to try and summon you today was because you're talking about how Periscope had all of these issues and you liked that post, but that was me like, oh, cool, he's interested and maybe agrees. When did you first invest in Clubhouse?
Well, I've always wanted a product like this. And I pitched actually a friend of mine, David King, on doing something like this. And he was doing something in the space. And then Twitter announced they were doing something else in the space. So then he sort of pivoted away. But he knew Paul Davidson pretty well. And Paul actually, and Paul and I used to work together at CoinList. Paul was CEO of CoinList briefly. And so I remember when Paul left, I said, man, you're meant to do a consumer products company and you're meant to do something that is like a small, hard charging team, just building something for lots and lots of people. That was clearly his superpower. So when he started Clubhouse, I begged him to let me invest. And this was before it was anything really. And I think he gave me a smaller allocation than I hoped for, which is the story of our relationship. But he's a fantastic guy and I'm lucky and happy to be an investor. That said, I do hope a decade from now that we're still not locked into centralized social platforms.
Yeah. I think that's awesome because in your defense or in any investor's defense, like I think it's unfair that people say, oh, all these investors are promoting Clubhouse. But I'm like, if you didn't like it, you wouldn't talk about it or be on it. Like, you have to enjoy the platform. Otherwise, it's useless, right? So,
Of course. I mean, there are people who are much larger investors than me who have spoken far fewer words on Clubhouse. And you know, in a way, I'm almost slightly resentful. I'm like, hey, I'm just making you richer. Why aren't you doing your share, right? I don't see anybody else creating rooms to pull you in, right? But that said, I also reserve the right to drop out of Clubhouse at any moment. And in fact, there was a round in between after the round where I invested, where they raised more money and had a chance to put more in, and I passed. And I passed because I felt this sort of subtle obligation for me to spend more time on Clubhouse. And also, it was a very crowded round. And I wanted to like make room for new investors and help the founder. But also, I just didn't want to be on the hook because I felt like, okay, if I keep investing, they're going to have big expectations out of me. Now, keep in mind, this is before Clubhouse had totally taken off. And I was one of probably the few people on the platform who were pulling people in. Now there's a lot of them, obviously. But I just didn't want to be a performing monkey. I didn't want a show. You know, I didn't even want the obligation for a show. I didn't want the pressure for a show. And so I'm not here trying to make my Clubhouse investment successful. My Clubhouse investment is tiny compared to many, 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 many other investments I have. I just think it's an incredibly well-designed product that's really needed for this moment. One of the problems with Twitter is, as Twitter's degenerated, it becomes very difficult to speak on Twitter because everything you say is just an excerpt of what you're actually thinking. It's not, you're not there to provide the context. And on Twitter, people will strawman you rather than steelman you. They will try to find the worst possible interpretation of what you said, and they'll try and attack it. So Clubhouse is much better because here, when you're talking to somebody else, well, firstly, most of the audience can't talk back. So we just stuck them into a box, which is too bad for them. But at least it keeps this conversation more pleasant for me. But also the people who are up here, because we're talking voice to voice, human to human, there's context. You're forced to be civil. I'm forced to be civil. We're forced to take each other, you know, at our best intentions, opposed to our worst intentions. It's like when you're in a cocktail party, you know, you don't end up fighting with everybody at the cocktail party, right? Like I remember I tweeted once at Jack Dorsey and I said, "What is Twitter?" And he basically said, "Oh, it's a place for people to have conversations. It's a town hall for conversations." And it is absolutely no such thing. There are not high quality conversations taking place on Twitter. Twitter is like a bar brawl. You know, people are going in and throwing chairs and beer at each other. So maybe it starts as a town hall, but it always ends in a fist fight. So it's a very different kind of medium. It ends up being a broadcast medium. Twitter is a brilliant broadcast medium if you just want to show up, drop something there and then leave and not actually interact. At least that's the way it feels for the big accounts. I know for little accounts, it is a completely different experience. But when you're a big account, that's basically all you can do. And it kind of sucks. I waste a lot of my time going through my Twitter feed and blocking people and muting people and then responding to the few civil, interesting people who actually have something genuine to say. And every day that goes by, those well-intentioned people are getting drowned out by a larger and larger army of spammers and haters. And so it just becomes impossible to have conversations on Twitter. So I'm grateful that something like Clubhouse exists where you can speak in context. Now, interestingly, I've never had a bad incident speaking at Clubhouse on Clubhouse. But what will sometimes happen is people will excerpt something from what I said on Clubhouse. They'll turn it into a tweet. They'll often even just misinterpret what I was saying. So they just say something else. And then somebody else will jump on it and attack it. Like there were a bunch of VR phonies who recently say, oh, because I was joking around with Joe Rogan about VR not being prime time at this exact moment is the point I was making. It's obviously not widespread. It doesn't work today because Joe was saying, why aren't we in Clubhouse VR? And I was like, because VR doesn't work yet. But of course, I'm a believer in VR. I invest in a lot of VR companies. I think it will work, but it's just not there yet. But of course, these people on Twitter jumped on, aha, Naval hits VR. Look how wrong he is. And look how correct we are. And look how we got him on this one. How he doesn't get the future. But you can only do that on Twitter, where you can take people out of context, because it is a context-free machine.
My question is about your comments around decentralization of the social media networks or platforms. How do you see that happening? What does that road ahead look like?
So decentralization doesn't mean that you put everything on a blockchain. It just means that you take the important metadata, such like the user ID, the follow graph, and you know, a few important pieces of content, and the ones that are persistent, let's just say, and you put those in the blockchain. And then everything else, the blockchain has a pointer either to a site that can do hosted audio streaming or host files, or maybe just has a JSON file which has everyone's tweets on it. So basically what the blockchain does is it doesn't give you moment-to-moment decentralization. What it gives you is the ability to exit. It gives you the ability to leave. So, you know, today, for example, I'm Naval on Twitter, right? If tomorrow I say something that displeases the powers that be at Twitter, and I can't imagine their trust and safety team is thrilled with how much I call them out. So I've got to be on a hit list somewhere, right? But they're still, like, they don't have anything on me. But nevertheless, I'm one of those people that would be convenient if I were to, you know, stop talking about some of the things I say on there. So let's say that the Twitter trust and safety team finds something I say objectionable and they want to block my account. So they suspend it or they delete my account, right? Now, all of a sudden, the 1.1 million and change followers that I have are lost. If you were looking at a blockchain version of Twitter, what would happen is it's not the tweets and all the files would be held in the blockchain, but what would be held in the blockchain would be just my handle and all the people pointing to that. And I would control my handle. And so if Twitter suddenly blocks me, then I would just redirect the pointer from my handle at Naval, which went to twitter.com/Naval, and I would put it towards some other website that was now competing with Twitter and would now suddenly have a shot, because all my followers, when they clicked on my profile or tried to fetch tweets for me from some desktop client, it would instead now fetch them from this new site. So that single little piece of metadata, the pointer to my name, if that can be decentralized, then the whole thing is effectively decentralized. And the clearest example of this is the domain name system. You can, for example, be kicked off of, you know, let's say your website, let's say you're posting on Medium. If you're on medium.com and you write something they don't like, they can kick you off. But if you have your own domain, then they can't. And even if your hosting provider tries to kick you off, they can't, because you will just take your domain name and you'll point it to a different hosting provider. So at the beginning, we can bring that level of decentralization to social media. The hard part is actually it's not the technology, it's a collective action problem, which is we're all locked into Twitter as our shelling point. And because they're centralized and they've been around for a while, they have the best technology, they have the best app, they have the best user experience, and they just have all the people. So they've gotten us all into a single place. And now someone has to say, hey, guys and gals over here, psst, follow me. We're going to go to this different place. It's like if you've been out with a large group, right? You're out with like 8 or 10 people at night and you're all trying to decide where to go for dinner, for example, or whose house to go to spend the evening. And once everyone kind of settles in into one restaurant or into one person's house, trying to get them to move as a group is nearly impossible. Well, now we're faced with the same problem, but involving hundreds of millions of people. So it's actually going to be very difficult to convince people to move over to these decentralized social networks. That said, they're going to have a couple of things going for them. So they obviously start out way behind in terms of user experience and in terms of users. But here's what they do offer the world. They offer 4 things that you can't get elsewhere. One is you get immutability. Your content is forever, your followers are forever. Second thing you get is you get payments. So it has built-in payments, which entrepreneurs can do incredible things with that are gonna make Twitter super follow look like nothing. The third thing you can do is you can get programmability and composability. So it can connect into the rest of the all the other crypto-based apps. And you can also get programmers writing code without even need for APIs. The code itself will all be open because the data underneath is protected through private keys and blockchain consensus. And the last thing you get is you get peer governance. You get the users themselves are deciding the future of the platform. They're taking ownership and agency as opposed to leaving it up to a small group of benevolent dictators.
So Naval, on that point, I think your last point actually probably answers my question. But when you talk about like a decentralized world for social media, I don't think you think that hate speech is the same as free speech. So, for example, what happened to Parler may not happen on a decentralized world. But what you're saying is peer governance would fix that. Is that right?
I don't think you can define the words hate speech as a problem. I think the moment you create a category, and there's no exception for hate speech in the US Constitution for a good reason, because I can just define whatever I don't like as hate speech if I'm in charge. So creating a category called hate speech is the same as shutting down free speech. So these decentralized social networks will be uncensorable in the sense that you won't be able to forbid people from saying or writing certain things. That said, each one will have a client and you will choose which client to use. So Twitter will be a client into the blockchain as opposed to being the only place of canonical data. And what will happen is different clients will enforce different moderation and censorship policies. So some clients might be free for all, everything goes, and they're going to be really toxic places. Nobody will want to hang out there. Others might be quite controlled, might even be safe enough for our children, which Twitter certainly is not today. There might be ones that might just say, hey, we only want peaceful content. Anybody uses curse words, they're thrown off this thing. Others might say, we want all intellectual discourse except for racist speech, right? And we get to define what that is, and we're in charge. So that's just the way it is. But people will have a choice. Even with Twitter, you're seeing that there's a giant breakdown in norms just across countries. Like India wants Twitter to remove certain accounts, and Twitter's saying they're not going to do it. Yet when the Western governments tell Twitter to remove certain accounts, they do it. So Twitter itself is already being torn apart by definitions of what kind of speech. So no, I reject the idea that like there's any definition of undesirable speech. The problem is who gets to decide? That's the person in charge. You might as well make them king and dictator. I'll tell you what, I'm fine with hate speech. Just let me define what the heck it is.
I wanted to let Hannah jump in because I know she was super motivated at the start and helped us summon you. Hannah, please jump in.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Salva. Naval, I just had a quick question. I know you shared some really awesome insights about happiness earlier, and my question is pretty lighthearted, but does pineapple on pizza make you happy, or is it the worst thing in the world?
I grew up in New York, so unfortunately, I would have to categorize it as an abomination. It probably should be illegal. And if I could censor pineapple and pizza photos, I would.
Saba, would you mind if I ask you another question real quick?
When you ask so pleasantly, I don't think any of us could ever say no to that, Rahul. Please go for it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, Naval, actually, another question is, if you were in your 20s now, is there anything new you might work on, like any new idea or like any new concept?
I mean, this is to beat a dead horse, but I'd be all over crypto and DeFi and probably decentralized social network.
Oh, okay. Cool. Thank you.
Saba, would you mind if I ask a follow-up?
Please
sorry,
do it,
I,
yeah.
apologies. I didn't get to finish because I had to take a drink of water.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please continue.
No, it's okay. I also think VR and AR are actually going to be extremely interesting. I don't think the technology is quite there yet, and I don't know if it's in the reach of startups to work on it because it does require a lot of resources. But I do think it's, you know, there's still a certain inevitability to those things. Look, technology is a broad frontier, right? And it's quite the set of things that don't quite work yet. What are the things that don't quite work yet that we want them to work? You know, my friend Balaji Srinivasan, who is brilliant guy, he has a framework that I kind of like for where he basically says immutable money, infinite frontier, and immortal life. So what he means by that is cryptocurrencies, space travel, and anti-aging. So those are kind of the three things that he identifies as sort of the most important things that we can do in humanity. So I think any of those three is kind of an interesting area to think about and work on.
Sweet.
So, okay, well, I'll jump in then. So Naval, on a kind of different topic, I am also an angel investor focused on Chicago startups. And I'm also very involved with like nonprofits and trying to give of time. And I've realized that anytime I give like in the Adam Grant sense of like give and take, I always get at least 10x back what I give. In lots of different, you can measure that in lots of different ways. And as I work with my founders, I realize that they don't have the time, the sort of mental capacity, like the room for them to put themselves in those kind of giver situations in the sense of, you know, like mentoring or getting involved with a nonprofit. And one of the barriers there is just like giving money. So I actually created a model and I just wanted to run it past you really quick because I'd love to open source this as like a social impact model to help investors, founders, and nonprofits. Would you be open to like, if I gave you 30 seconds to a minute on that?
You know, honestly, I don't think it's a great use of time for everybody here.
okay, that's fine. That's fine.
Like, I'm just saying, like, I think people are here for a different reason and they don't want to hear a pitch.
And yeah, no,
the room should feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. But I think we just fall in this trap where then we're just going to end up going round robin and getting pitched. And I'm sure all of the reasons are great, and I'm sure all of the models are interesting, but this is not the right venue. So,
oh yeah, totally. That's fine. It wasn't meant to be a pitch in terms of like an investment or anything. It's something I want to open source, but
you're trying to get an idea out there. But the other thing I would say is, instead of spending a minute asking permission to say the idea, just say the idea. I mean, just say it. Two sentences, go.
So I created a model where I, as an investor, write a check to a nonprofit that my founders select. And those founders then get the opportunity over that year to engage directly with that nonprofit. And through that, they've been doing mentoring and all these, like the value that they've gotten has been insane. The value that the nonprofit has gotten, which is Future Founders in Chicago, has been insane. And the idea is giving this to other investors so that they can enable their founders to get the same level. And as you know, when you go to places where you give first, you get so much more in return.
You should create a website for it. You should brand it, and you should open source. You should put it up there. It's like Y Combinator has safe docs, right? So you could have call it something clever, and you know, go ahead and put the docs out there for it. And then you know, if it's a good idea, people will copy it. They'll use it. They'll imitate it. That's the beauty of the internet.
And that's literally what we're doing. It's called Invested Forward. But anyway, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that to be like a pitch. I really do appreciate your feedback.
Invested Forward. There it is.
Yeah.
So I think that's great.
Cool. Hey, Saba, thanks for doing this. And Naval, here's a quick question. Well, what is a question or topic that no one has ever asked you, but you wish someone would ask you?
I love that.
Oh, I don't really care what people ask me. There's no hidden cards here. There's nothing I'm trying to tell the world. There's nothing I'm holding back. And anything I wish people had asked me? No, I don't want people asking me more things. It's fine. Ask whatever you want. I'm just a machine that's spitting back data at you, right? Based on what you put in. It's like a vending machine. You're putting in a quarter and you're pressing a button and you're getting an answer back. You're pressing on some genes and some memory cells and some neurons. I do not have an agenda here.
So. All right. Well, then here's another quick
quarter, sorry,
if you will. Who is someone that, I mean, you've talked to so many people. Who's someone that you've never talked to that it would almost be a dream for you to have a conversation with?
No dreams, but I'm very impressed by the works of David Deutsch, who's the author of The Beginning of Infinity and The Fabric of Reality, and I've never talked to him. But don't use this as a way to mount some campaign to go talk to him, because that'll be an embarrassment. It won't be a natural conversation. There was a point where I was going through and I did have kind of my bucket list, and I was like, oh, cool. I got to meet Nassim Taleb, and I got to meet Nick Szabo, and I got to meet Vitalik Buterin, and I got to meet Neil Stevenson, and you know, I kind of went through the checklist, and Scott Adams is another one, and Tim Ferriss, of course. But after you go through enough of these, you know, at some point you just realize, hey, they're just people, they're interesting people, but no one of them is somehow suddenly going to transform your life or create some amazing conversation. My favorite conversations are with books. It's when I sit there and I read some really interesting book and I get the author's best work and their best mindset, and I get to engage at my speed and my leisure. And obviously I don't have the back and forth discussion with them. But actually, when it comes to learning, I actually think that conversations take a distant second place to both books, or maybe even a third place to books and just thinking for yourself. I don't mean to sound arrogant, like I'm not... But I would say that the majority of what I've learned through in life is by reading and then by applying it but then by reflecting on it. It has not been through conversations. I do learn things through conversations, of course, and they tend to be timely, news-oriented, business, news, politics, or even just kind of ideas for like, where should I live? And, you know, those sorts of very practical things. But if you're talking about the important timeless principles that will make you happier or will make you wealthier or just set you apart from everyone else, you're much more likely to find that through books and self-reflection than by talking to anybody. Like sitting here and listening to me, you're doing it because you're bored, okay? It's not really a form of self-improvement. If you're putting this in the self-improvement bucket, you're deluding yourself. This is entertainment. This is the entertainment bucket. That's where I put it. So if you're having fun, fantastic. If you're here to learn something, you're probably in the wrong place.
Well, I guess I just learned I got to go read a book then.
There you go.
Thank you.
In fact, I've been doing a lot of Clubhouse recently, and I wasn't going to come back on because at some level, I also feel like my job is not to come here and be redundant, to say the same things over and over. I'm not a talking head. I'm not a Jordan Peterson where I have like a message to get out. I'm not a public intellectual like Sam Harris. I'm just a curious person who has a lot of the same basic desires the rest of you do, which is I want to be happier and calmer, and I still like making money, and I want to have a good family life and all of those things. So I tend to focus mostly on those, and I need to spend more time learning and kind of feeding my own brain and my own curiosity, rather than regurgitating what I know for the thousandth time until you all get sick of me. And, you know, then start creating some kind of a Navalism where Naval has certain beliefs and not others. I don't know, half the stuff that's even that almanac that Eric Jorgensen put together, I probably contradicted at some point. Some of it now is cringe inducing when I read it. And some of it I just flat out disagree with.
Hey, Naval.
So I totally agree with that, Naval. And I read the book, I listen to the podcast almost every night before I go to sleep. And I think it's actually a reminder. It is actually really useful to us to hear the same things. It's obviously not useful for you to say the same things again, but it is a point of, you know, having listened to that podcast again. So agreed as well. Roxy, go for it.
Noel, what do you like the most about Elon Musk?
One second, Roxy. Please go.
I know it's not my turn to ask my question, so I'll wait for that. But one thing I was going to say is that I do kind of disagree with you when you said this is purely entertainment, and that if people are listening to learn, then they're probably, I don't remember exactly the quote after that, but I just want to disagree with that because there are a lot of people in this room. This room has over 3,000 people, and for you just don't know who's learning from what. So I think to say that it's purely entertainment, even some of the things that I've heard while, you know, people have asked you questions, and it's not even just so much as what you're saying, but sometimes it's the way and how you answer it, or the way that you structure the sentences, or the particular words that you choose to say when you answer the question. Those are learning experiences for some people. So I just wanted to interject and say that I disagree on that point.
Well, that's kind of you. That's very kind of you. I don't know how I became a good speaker. I didn't used to be, or at least I didn't have that reputation when I was younger. I guess it just happened somewhere along the way. So who knows, something like similar might happen to you.
Hey, Naval, can I say something? I'm not sure if I'm in order here or if we're going in order.
You know what? Let's keep some order to this chaos. Why not? Let's go to Ronak.
No problem.
Yeah.
Hi, Naval. You have mentioned this many times that one person, Elon Musk, makes you feel like, are you doing interesting things in your life? So what do you like most about him?
Well, I think, look, I've met Elon a few times, and but I know him much more by his public persona than his private person. So let's separate the two out. Let's just go with the public persona, which is kind of what everyone here is familiar with. I think what's inspiring about his public persona is that he is optimistic. He is future focused, and he is a person of action. And we're just lacking that across the board. There's a lot of billionaires in this world. Most of them are boring. Elon Musk is doing interesting things and taking risks. He's a builder. He's passionate. He's doing things that are unequivocally good for humanity, or trying to. So I think all of that is very inspirational, and we need more people like that. We need more heroes like that, so that we don't get trapped in this zero-sum game narrative of, you know, rich people bad and poor people good, what Nietzsche used to call slave morality, which was the inversion of the old classical antiquities morality, where power and might and were seen as goods, and, you know, later weakness was in victimhood were seen as goods. So we kind of go through these pendulums where either the person on top, the lion, the Caesar, is in charge. That's good. That's what we want. That's what our animal instincts want. But then we're preached through Christianity or Puritanism or progressivism that weakness and victimhood are good. But the reality is, you know, neither is good. You don't want a strong man. You don't want to be a victim. All of us can achieve. All of us can self-actualize in the best way possible. All of us just need to show up and be our best selves. And that's what Elon is doing. He's being his best self in public. It is just completely shocking to me when someone criticizes Elon Musk publicly, and you can just see the jealousy dripping off the tweet. You can literally just see that the sheer unhappiness and the misery that this person is in when all they can do is criticize someone who has done so much. So it just reveals more about the critic than it does about the so-called man in the arena, which is Elon Musk. So yeah, he's impressive. He does make me question if I'm doing everything I could with my life if I'm thinking big enough. That said, I have no desire to be Elon Musk. I don't want to die on Mars. I'm perfectly happy on Earth. I'm not obsessed with building rockets or electric vehicles. I admire them as technological marvels. But he does make me say, there's a guy who's following his most intense passions and he's following them publicly. And am I following my own passions as intensely as he is following his? So I just want to make sure I'm not leaving anything on the table. But I'm a very, very different person. You know, I kind of, it's funny, I made myself like a, I went through this a few years ago where I was like, so what is it that I want to do with my life, right? What is the thing that I want out of my life? And I set three targets for myself internally. And I basically just said, okay, you know, I want to have a certain kind of a media presence, but I don't want to try or do any work for it. I want to make a certain amount of money, but I'm not going to try and I don't want to do any work at it. And I want to have a certain level of peace and happiness in my life. And I don't want to try, and I don't want to do any work at it. And if none of these things materialize, I want to be perfectly okay with the outcome. So that was kind of the idle goals that I set for myself. And, you know, I'm pretty happy to say that, yeah, I hit all three of them. And I didn't really try and I didn't really work at it. So far, so good, right? And it's not to say that it's effortless. I actually did put in a lot of quote unquote effort, as someone else would have thought looking from the outside. I was working all day, or I was hustling all day, or I'm clubhousing all night. But the reality is I always did it on my own terms. So it didn't feel like work to me. My brother actually, I don't know if he realizes this, but he kind of made an impression on me one time, because he was with a friend of his, and his friend looked very successful, looked very financially successful, looked very socially successful. This is when I was much younger. And he said, he relayed a quote from this guy to me who said, I've always done whatever I wanted. And I was like, wow, he's got all that. All of that. So, and he just did whatever he wanted. So I at least resolved that I wouldn't be miserable in the journey, right? That I was going to do it the way that I wanted and still get what I wanted. And so I adopted that almost as a little motto in the background. Now, ironically, I think that guy ended up in a lot of trouble. I think he lost a lot of money for his investors. I think he got divorced. I think he may have even been sued or one step out of jail. So not to say it goes well for everybody, but hey, it worked for me.
Hey, Naval. Hi. This is El Janelle here at the bottom. So first, I want to say I'm just super excited to hear you talk, because me personally,
El Janelle. I'm so sorry. There have been people. No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I'll wait.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I just want to give people a chance who have been waiting patiently. Veda, welcome. Oops. Frank. Sorry. Frank. Hello.
Hey. How are you? Naval, to your point, there's a lot of entertainment in all this. And to Roxy's point, there's a lot of people learning. But for the sake of entertainment, because I think there's over 3,000 people in here, let's stick to that. Give us a guilty pleasure, something that we can't read about.
Well, if you couldn't read about it, then why would I tell you here? It's the same thing.
I was concerned you were going to trap me. You know, I'm a huge fan of Big Brains, and I thought I thought I might lose that.
No, it's like,
give us something, like, Naval.
Yeah, people put out that tweet where they're like, "Hey, you know, what's one thing that you believe that you can't say publicly?" Psst, right? It's like, yeah, the last thing you would do is tweet that. Look, every secret that I'm comfortable revealing is an open book. I don't have any secrets in my life for my friends and family, at least not, you know, nothing that they care about.
Nothing so dirty. Give us something fun.
I don't know, man. My life is actually really simple and really boring. I mean, I basically just get up. If it's a good day, I meditate and I work out. If it's a bad day, I skip my meditation and workout. Then I get on the phone. I just basically do a bunch of phone calls. I do a bunch of emails. I go for a walk, you know, make dinner, play with the kids, go to bed. Like, that's my average day, and just repeat ad nauseum. Oh, yeah. And I read a lot in between. Like, during the day, I'm reading way too much Twitter. But I also open up my iBooks or my Kindle, and I'll just read pages from a book. And at nighttime, I'll usually read, call it, depending on the book, anywhere between 20 to 100 pages before I go to bed. Okay, I'll give you one. I listen to podcasts in the shower, right? So I'll put my AirPods out in the shower. So a long time ago, I decided that whether Apple says they're waterproof or not, AirPods are expendable. So I would just put on the AirPods and I would go in the shower and I would have a podcast playing. I've got my Apple Watch so I can kind of cycle through the podcast itself. So now the problem with this is I've turned what would have been a beautiful meditative time for introspection in the shower into suddenly being like, you know, yet more time to cram media into my brain, which is not necessarily a good thing. So it's not to say that this is some kind of a life hack which should be on the Tim Ferriss blog, but once in a while, I will just listen to podcasts while in the shower, and there you go.
I love that we eventually got there, because when you ask a question, the best thing to do is just shut up after you ask it. Let people just tell a story.
sure. Yeah, that's smart. It's like there's a hack. Like, if somebody doesn't want to do something, right, and you're trying to figure out why, let's say like you're trying to sell somebody a product and they won't buy it. If you say, well, why won't you buy it? They'll give you a reason. And that first reason is always the wrong reason. It's the cover story, right? So sometimes you have to ask them again. You'll say, well, okay, got that. Any other reasons? And they'll give you the other reason. And it's like the last reason they give you, the one you have to drag out of them, that's the real reason.
Exactly. Layer your questions. You'll get to it.
I just wanted to add, I'm getting a lot of messages, Naval, of people saying, hey, bring this person up. This podcast is here. This host is here. This celebrity is here. And I think... we see you as the person, the person of the people. And so, you know, maybe there are great minds on stage, and I think there already are. But the point is, we just wanted to equal it out for letting anyone join the conversation. So, thanks to everyone that's been participating so far. And whether the questions are useful, entertaining, or intelligent or whatnot, like, this is amazing. So thank you so much.
Yeah, one thing I've decided that we don't need anymore is we don't need intermediaries, even the new social media intermediaries. And what do I mean by that? Even the Joe Rogans of the world, even the Tim Ferrisses of the world who are interviewing, you know, people, they're needed less now than they were before. So at first we needed the New York Times to get the word out. Then we had Twitter. Okay, then we, to get the long form out, we needed to be on CNN or Bloomberg or CNBC. And then we got Joe Rogan. Well, now we don't even need Joe Rogan because you're Clubhouse. You can just get on and go straight. So I got invited into various Clubhouse rooms to be interviewed. And I was like, why do I need you to interview me? I can just go straight on Clubhouse and I can talk directly to anyone that I want to talk to. And I think that's beautiful. So that's why I tend not to drop into pre-scheduled rooms here. That strikes me as anachronistic. That's like the old model. And it's also, look, it's very hard to speak on a broad variety of topics on demand for long periods of time without saying something stupid or without repeating yourself. And so generally, these repeat commentator type people end up having to just interview others because they just run out of things to say themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Joe Rogan, poor guy, he's been on, 1,500 episodes. He's got nothing left to say that he hasn't already said over and over and over again. So of course he has to interview people. And what makes Rogan interesting is he interviews people not just about news or politics or sports, which are kind of the normal frequent use topics, the frequent conversation topics. He brings on people from all different walks of life, from academia to science to, you know, martial arts to psychedelics to what have you. And he'll interview each one of them very thoroughly. He does a lot of homework. He's actually the single most prepared interviewer I've ever encountered by far. When I talked to him for 2 hours, that man was present 100% of the time. There was not one moment where he lost his train of thought. And I remember, because I'm usually that guy, and I lost my train of thought at one point in that episode and I got lost for a brief moment. And I look back and to my surprise, he was still completely focused. He was so present. Anyway, impressive guy. But you just run out of material. So I'm not going to get up here and interview people. But at the same time, I don't need people to interview me either.
I love it. Well, I'm doing the opposite of that exactly, but better. Sorry to be an intermediary, but why don't you ask your question if you're back now?
It's fine if you're running crowd control for me. Although, you know, in the few times I've run crowd control by calling people in the Clubhouse rooms, I'm brutal. I give them 30 seconds and I kick them off the stage.
Yeah.
Precisely to prevent people from like giving ads or just rambling.
I love it. Thank you. Rahul, it looks like it's you then.
All right.
Oh, wait, no, sorry. I was here just to listen.
Okay, cool. Right, hi, Samuel.
Thanks, guys. And Naval, you're spot on. Here I am with just 5 followers. I think I'm up to 18 now, but this Clubhouse allows a space where I can talk to people who have a lot more social media exposure than others. So thank you for that. And thank you, Clubhouse, for doing this. And thanks, Saba, for summoning Naval to the stage. I think I need to change my icon. I'm here in Tokyo, Japan. I just left a dojo which had no Wi-Fi. Did everyone change their face back from not Naval? So I apologize if I'm missing that.
You're the last one, bro. Frankly, it's embarrassing.
I apologize. I'll do it right after this.
I'm just kidding. But it's fine. I don't look at this either, by the way. Like, this is a 20-year-old anime rendition of what I probably look like in some fantastical imaginary life. So yeah, it's probably just better that we all just use our imagination.
Like it. I wanted to expand on a concept that you put out there, I think in your tweet storm back in 2018. You said something to akin to, we should try to set your own hourly wage and then outsource everything else. My question is, from someone who personally has kind of been pinched by the coronavirus and lost business, how can we expand on it and get back from 0 to 1? Obviously, I still need to look at an hourly framework, but how, if you could just kind of expand that thought a little on how to get back to just setting your hourly wage and outsourcing everything else. Thank you.
Yeah, it's not some hard and fast prescription. It's not as if, if my wife talks to me, I'll be like, quiet, this is like below my hourly wage, right? Or she'll say, pick up your socks, and I'll be like, oh, it's below my hourly wage, right? So it's not that kind of thing. It's not meant to be a hard and fast rule. It's just kind of a general understanding of, well, look, I want to be in a certain place. Someone who's in that place would be earning this much roughly. And so I'm not going to be there while I'm behaving like some person at a much lower wage. And so it just reminds me to save time, and save time by hiring people, by outsourcing things, by not coupon clipping, by not counting frequent flyer miles, which is, I think, the coupon clipping for the middle class people, where they spend so much of their time optimizing frequent flyer miles, they could have just gotten another job instead. Obviously, this requires you to have a career or a job where your earning is somewhat under your control, where you can put in more hours and earn more. But I would argue that for anyone who has any ambition to create any wealth, you have to be in creative endeavors. You have to be creating things, brand new things. That's the only way to get to wealth. So if you're going to be creating things, then you need creators' time. Creators need a lot of free time. They need a broad and open mind. If you look at entrepreneurs, right, who are successful, yes, they grind all the time, but that initial moment of entrepreneurship when they created their company, that was the point where they made like the hardest and most important decision. If they'd created in the wrong space, or they started with the wrong person, or they structured the wrong way, no amount of hard work would have saved them later. It's like when you build an app, if you're Paul Davidson and Rowan Seth and you create Clubhouse, that is way better than like trying to create 1,000 apps and grinding through it and, starting in the wrong place. So creativity is the point of leverage, and creativity requires a free mind. It requires open space. It requires open time. And so if you aspire to be a creator, and if you aspire to be wealthy, then you can't have a busy calendar. This is not an excuse for laziness. This basically means that now all of your time is going into your creative and intellectual endeavors. So for me, as far back as I can remember, no matter what job I was in, and no matter even what company I was doing, when I would come home late at night and I'd be tired from work, what would I do? I'd have a couple of friends come over and we'd brainstorm on startups. I was always brainstorming on the next thing because it was exciting to me. That's what I wanted to do. So just protect your time. Don't spend your time doing things that other people can do. Don't spend your time doing the mundane. Don't spend your time, unless you enjoy it. Like, if you enjoy it, then it doesn't matter. So another way I would put it is, like, you want to spend all your time either learning, earning, or relaxing. And relaxing is a broad category. Relaxing includes spending time with your kids if you have them, or exercising if that's what you want to do. So relaxing is just the category of things where, like, these are things that I enjoy doing. But other than that, you want to be learning and earning. Okay, you could also probably add fitness into that, right? Exercise, sure, great. but you kind of don't want to do anything else. Not if you're a creative person, not if you have some leverage, not if you have some ambition, you want to be outsourcing everything else. The classic example here is returning things, right? Like you order something. Now these days it's a little different with Amazon, but in the old days you buy something, that thing breaks, right? Most people will go back to the store and they'll wait in line at customer service and they'll argue over things and they'll waive their receipt, you know, or they'll sit on hold with customer service for an hour to get a $10 refund. Well, you just said your time's worth 10 bucks. It's actually worse than that, because that hour you spent on phone with customer service, not only did it cost you an hour, but it cost your emotional well-being. You're probably angry the whole time. So then there's another hour that you lost being angry and calming down from it. And really, how many creative hours in a day do you have? It's like two or three. It's not a lot. So if you burn those creative hours on activities that are frustrating or menial, you will not get the chance to be creative. And unfortunately, the world is not rigged in such a way that the harder you work, the more you get. Hard work is a prerequisite. It is an ingredient, but you cannot outwork everybody else. There just aren't that many hours in the day. So Elon Musk he works hard, but he's not necessarily working harder than someone who runs a grocery store in the pandemic. He just can't. There just aren't more hours in the day. So it is much more about how he chooses to spend his time that helps get him to where he is. And obviously, when he was a kid, he spent a lot of that time learning science and possibly rocketry and equations and running businesses and things that, you know, other kids were having fun socializing and playing in the swimming pool or who knows what, right? They were just allocating their time differently. So it's not about increasing the time you have, it's about time allocation. So setting your hourly wage is just a way of saying is I choose to allocate my time to the things that I think are important. And this is a cutoff below which I will consider these things unimportant.
Awesome. Thank you.
I feel like I could say one word sometimes and you could speak for hours on it, which is something we'll test another day. Kaula.
Probably true.
Kaula, go ahead. Hey. All right.
She's maybe offended because I said the name wrong, maybe, or she maybe can't speak, which is totally fine.
Or, the audio. Hi, yeah. Roxy.
Thank you so much for patiently waiting. Really appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so, Naval, you hinted on trust and safety a bit earlier when you were talking, but my question is, do you see a conflict with the way... No, let me scrap that. Let me not ask that. I'll put it in there. Okay, with the way that trust and safety is growing, do you see a conflict between the idea of independent tech companies kind of growing trust and safety in addition to their revenue models? The reason why I say that is because, like, when you take Twitter for a prime example, oftentimes Twitter does profit from the controversy that happens on their platform. And so when you get into this arena, I guess, of self-regulation or trying to figure out what is considered hate speech, like you mentioned earlier, does that conflict with the idea of a trust and safety department and the way that it may grow within an independent tech company going forward when a lot of tech companies do profit from some of these occurrences?
Well, free speech is something that has been litigated as a society, and what we converge upon is what the laws of the land are. So if it's legal to say it, you should be able to say it on Twitter. The fact they have to layer something more on top and be more restrictive is where I kind of have problem with it. Trust and safety is a very Orwellian kind of organization. You know, it's the Ministry of Truth. The liars always call themselves the Ministry of Truth. And the trust and safety organization is basically saying, actually, we have a different code than of speech that is allowed here. And even that would be fine. It's a private company. I get that. But it is a monopoly. It is a network effect-based monopoly on microblogging. And anyone who has their head screwed on straight in the tech industry knows that. It's a dirty secret of the tech industry that it just leads to these aggregator monopolies, at least until blockchains come along and decentralize all the things. And so in this monopolistic situation that we're in, what we find is that the town square is run by a private company, and that private company has a different definition of free speech than what we have conversion upon as a society with our laws and rulings and constitutions and various titles and acts and legislation. if speech should be limited, then that is a debate, which I think would be a horrible thing. But that is a debate that should be had at a societal level, and we should modify the constitution for that. It should not be decided by a private company that finds itself in a utility-like position and becomes a monopoly. And it is invariably true that that trust and safety team will get captured by certain actors. To all the people out there who say that it's great for the trust and safety team and Twitter's a private company and they can do whatever they want, how would you react if tomorrow Peter Thiel and Donald Trump and a few other billionaires came in and bought Twitter? Would you still be rooting for them as a private company to be allowed to do whatever they want? Obviously not. And that exposes the hypocrisy of the whole situation.
Really great points. Thank you.
All right. Kaula, welcome back. How is your audio this time? Kaula?
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you guys for so much for putting this together. And Naval, thank you so much for coming into this room. So my question is centered around ethical wealth creation. So I think that the definition of ethics tends to be subjective, or at least these days it is absolutely subjective, depending whether you are, let's say you believe in God or a higher being, or and whether you don't. Ethics can be extremely subjective. So when you think about ethical wealth creation, how do you see that?
Yeah, that's a good point. I believe you're correct in that a lot of what is ethics would be subjective. But I believe that there's also certain objective things that we as a society agree upon as ethics. And those things we have actually codified into laws in many cases. So examples of things that I think we would all agree fall within the domain of ethics are honesty. You don't want to lie to people, right? So if you're a company that's actively lying to people or even withholding material information, that is an example of non-ethical. Another thing I think that many of us could say would be unethical would be rent seeking through regulatory capture. So if you're making money mostly because you bribe regulators through some roundabout lobbyist scheme, then that is somewhat unethical. Then you can kind of get into gray areas like smoking and, you know, if you're selling marijuana or pornography or psychedelics. And I think this is up to each person. So I kind of leave this a little bit more in the domain of the individual themselves. You have to comply with your own moral code. I'll tell you something interesting, though. I've met a lot of incredibly wealthy people, right? Incredibly wealthy people. And they're sort of an interesting bag. Firstly, one interesting point is they're generally less happy than the average person. Like that whole thing about like money doesn't buy you happiness and like rich people are unhappy, it weirdly turns out to be true. Most of them are miserable for reasons that I still have even a hard time wrapping my head around. But the second piece is that almost all of them believe deep down in their souls that they were doing something good for humanity while they did it. So you can disagree with that, but it's just the way people are hardwired. A lot of people have good intentions. Now, the weird thing is intentions don't forgive everything. So what then ends up being unethical? Dishonesty is a clear one. Violence, coercion is another one. So if you are doing something that may be legal in the United States, but it's like what you're doing internationally or overseas might be unethical, or in this case would be coercive to go get it, blood diamonds being a famous example, right? Then that is unethical. If we get into something like defense stuff, you know, just like Ministry of Truth is obviously the Ministry of Lies. Defense Department is obviously the Department of War, right? So if you're arming the Defense Department to go and blow people up, well, now that's borderline ethical, right? There are some people who will say that's unethical. Your reason is to bomb poor brown people in the Middle East. Well, another person might say, no, this is national defense. This is mom and apple pie. This is the military. You can't criticize the military. That's our army. They keep us safe. And these are boys getting blown up for us. Yeah, you know, there's the old line that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, right? It's just a question of which side you're on. So this is where it gets murky. So I don't think I'm like, I have some incredible grasp on ethics. But here's another point about ethics. When you are doing something unethical, you usually know it yourself. You know it. You know it's unethical. You know, because you have this weird feeling in your gut. And you're kind of like, and there's a part of you that goes, can I get away with this? Right? There's always like that little devil on your shoulder arguing with a little angel on your shoulder. I think most of us actually know when we're doing something unethical. So maybe it just even boils down to listening to your own moral self. I will say that I have found that people who generally engage in what most of us would call unethical behavior, and sure, it happens, you know, I would say that those people are generally not very happy people. They themselves view everyone else in the world around them as equally unethical. So they're just distrustful and they're not connected to other humans. And deep down, I do believe that self-esteem is the reputation that you have with yourself. And so when you're cheating your own, according to your own moral code and nobody else's, then you know. So you have to live up to your own moral code, not as the others. Everyone has their own moral code. That's the beauty of humanity. We're all different. We all have different viewpoints. It's all subjective in that sense. But there are some collective sins. Coercing other people is a collective sin. That's why I'm so opposed to censorship. Censorship is literally silencing somebody. It's clapping their hand over their mouth and say, you're not allowed to say that. That is coercion. So silencing people, being dishonest, coercing people, forcing people, these are obviously the things I think that we can all agree upon that are unethical. Beyond that, I think it boils down a lot to your own personal moral code.
And do you see that being scalable? Do you see the concept of, you know, ethical wealth creation? So, for example, if we break it down, some of the financial institutions are, you know, basically have predatory practices that are taking advantage of, you know, the underbanked, of the poor. Do you have a vision or a way that we can scale ethical?
I'd be careful in that. Like, so for example, people have said for the longest time that payday loans are unethical and predatory. But if you actually look at payday lending as an industry and you dig into it, you actually find out there's good reasons why those interest rates are so high. There's a very high default rate. You know, it costs a lot to operate those shops, etc. So it's not always that clear cut. I think when it comes to business, if you see a monopoly operating, it's only a matter of time before they start being unethical. It's that Google was originally "Don't be evil," then they removed that from their motto, and now they censor freely. So, and they kick people off the Play Store, and they claim that, like, you know, Android was like this big open source thing, but they use all these various agreements and lock-ins to basically control Android, and it is a Google-owned farm. So, I think it's a nature of companies that when it's a nature of power. You know, the old line is power corrupts. Absolutely true. So when any person or any institution gains too much power, they inevitably end up corrupted. They inevitably, because people are subjective. Institutions are subjective. They want to do what's best for themselves. And they'll always cloud it and clothe it in making it look like it's good for everybody. So I actually think that if you have a free market and true free market where people are competing with each other on a relatively level playing field, then you will tend to get a good outcome. The pathological case that we have with the internet is that you have free market competition from the starting point, but then because of aggregator benefits and network effects and scale economies, the winners just tend to dominate everything. A friend of mine texted me today and he said, hey, who are the number 2, 3, 4 e-tailers behind Amazon? Go ahead, think it through for a second. It's almost impossible to answer. If you didn't have Amazon, who's the number 2 that would give you the same things? It's online. I'm not talking about offline. Yeah, offline, maybe you can go to Costco for a few things. It's nearly impossible to answer. And this is a freaking store to sell you things. This was a market that in the real world was taken up with thousands of competitors in every street corner. But now we only have one company that is shipping us everything. So it's just the nature of the internet that scale economies and network effects lead us to single monopolists. And these monopolists inevitably end up corrupted, no matter what their intentions are. It's just because power corrupts. Because when you have the power and you're forced to make the decisions for other people, you're always just going to do them from your point of view. And not everyone's going to agree with your point of view. So the only monopolist that ultimately doesn't get corrupted is one who hands over the power. And I don't even know if that is even possible. In fact, you could argue that the United States is a free country because George Washington turned down the third term. He was basically on his way to becoming a king. He was popular enough and he could have just done that and created a new monarchy and a new despotism. But he was perhaps one of the very, very few people in human history, possibly the only one, who passed up the kingship and said, nope, I'm just going to go and tend to my apple tree. And from that, you know, he saved the United States from becoming just yet another uninteresting dictatorship or monarchy. Perhaps that's giving him too much credit, but I think you get the point in that it's about control. I I think I'm probably going to have to go soon. I actually did have a lot to do tonight. So this was sort of my, this was unexpected and unplanned. So maybe I'll take one more question, then I'll hop off the air. Thank you, buddy.
All right. Thank you. We got lucky last, Ed, just in terms of the order that we had. Then Ed, make it a good one.
I don't know if it's a good one, but going back to your earlier point about how, you know, you get to choose your time on what you do and what you don't do. And I'm always curious about the origin of opinions. So like what was going on, you know, what was that? Why did you decide that was the thing to work on back in the day? As like the first part of the question, you grew up for answering that. The second one is it seemed like a lot of what happened, opinions kind of influenced everything you've done since. So kind of curious if you're up for talking about that at all. Either way, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually not the most interesting topic. I was just into startups. I wanted to start a company. That's the best idea I could come up with at the time. I've always been very opinionated. I thought there should be a place for product reviews. It actually turned out not to be the best idea in its original incarnation. The correct idea was what Yelp ended up becoming. And at the end of Opinions' lifespan, we were doing restaurant reviews and things like that. But keep in mind, this is before Google Maps existed and local mapping existed. So it was hard to map restaurant reviews and just a generic website in the cloud. So that was just like the first company I started. That's where I learned a lot about, you know, what kind of co-founders you recruit and how you build a hard-charging team and how you tangle with VCs. You know, these biographical stories, honestly, I'm not sure you're going to learn anything from them. And not even sure I'm going to learn anything from repeating them, because these are just narratives, right? They're stitched together narratives in my head, and there are no interesting, I've absorbed the ideas, right? So for example, I think my first philosophical tweet ever was, and I probably created, at least at a high level, you know, whatever they call it now, like fortune cookie Twitter or Gyan Twitter or, you know, VC advice Twitter, whatever the heck it was, right? But the tweet that launched it all was the first one, which where I said, if you can't see yourself working with someone for life, don't work with them for a day. And that was a tweet to myself, right? It was a tweet, it was a lesson to myself that was born out of the opinion saga, which was just go long-term, especially in your relationships. Don't engage in temporary relationships. It actually applies further than that. Don't engage in acquaintances. Don't engage in temporary friendships. This doesn't mean you don't give people a chance. You can absolutely hang out with somebody for a year but when you barely know them. But the day you decide that you're not going to be friends forever, there's no more point in investing time in that relationship, either for you or for them. They should be free to find someone who really is going to be a friend with them for life. And then you can, of course, go find someone you can be a friend with for life. So this was the tweet that launched it all. It did come out of my opinions experience because there were multiple times where I knew that I shouldn't be working with one or two of the people involved, but I basically went ahead and I did it for the money. I did it for the money, right? That's the classic reason why people do it, right? You catch people doing it. They're like, oh, I did it for my family. No, I did it for the money, right? And yeah. So that was a lesson. That was a hard-fought lesson. I learned that lesson. I wrote that little piece of nugget down as a reminder to myself. It was deliberately provocative because that's how you break through the noise, right? That's how you break through habit. And that one actually got a little bit of a reaction. And then I just started tweeting more and more stuff like that, more notes to myself, more thoughts to myself. And then next thing you know, I have a internet personality. So that's kind of fun. Maybe I can cash this in for some prizes later.
Speaking of that, I have a really funny question and to end it. And again, you've been so amazing. Is there a scientific or a specific reason why you follow 339 people on Clubhouse, or is it just a coincidence? Do you do nuggets like that? Like, do you drop things around for people to figure out? Like,
yeah, there's a numerology code in there. It's like, yeah, if you decode it properly, you get a private key, and the private key will unlock 1,000 Bitcoin.
So, well, I know you don't love astrology, but the 339 angel number means that you like divine purpose and you like to give back to the less fortunate. So I've found my own meaning for your 339 followers. So unless that changes, I'll keep believing that.
Well, I just followed you, so it's 340. So your beautiful symmetry is destroyed.
I have to Google that. Yeah.
And this simulation has come to an end. Thank you very much and good night.